Hello, hello. It's another case of mixtape and identity, and my guest this week is Alexi Toliopoulos. Thank you so much for joining me. This is episode 87 of Mixtape and Identity with Alexi Toliopoulos. So excited to get this episode over the line. If you've listened to the show for a while, I think I've talked about this quite a bit, but the way I got into Australian comedy was Finding Drago and Confessions. And I was so excited to get David from the House of Noi on the show and Cam James on the show. So to get Alexi and complete the set was a dream come true. I'm genuinely so excited about it. We've tried to make this happen for a little bit since actually Cam's episode came out, which is ages ago now. But our schedules haven't quite aligned, so we finally managed to make it happen, and I couldn't be happier with how it turned out. It's such a great chat. When I got the music, first of all, it's more or less what I expected from Alexi. There's some curveballs in there, some songs that I hadn't come across before, like Brendan the Big Dudes. But yeah, a lot of the things I sort of would have expected, you know, soundtrack music, a song from a Francis Ford Coppola movie, some Greek influences. But yeah, the songs were an absolute joy. Very quickly on that, if this is your first time listening, if you're maybe new to the show, basically how the show works is I sent Alexi a list of prompts, he sent me back a list of responses, and the songs that he picked, we're going to talk through why he picked those songs. They're all available in a playlist on Spotify, so if you click the link in the description of the podcast, you can find that there. This is such a fun chat. I'm sure you're listening because you know Alexi. It's what you expect. He's an absolute joy. It's very, very funny. Look, we'll jump in. This is episode 87 of Mixtape Identity with Alexi Toliopoulos. You actually listen to music at the moment?
I listen to music every single day, almost every day of my life, sometimes by choice, sometimes not by choice. You know, I could be wandering the streets and I could hear a humble busker playing his fiddle and I'll be like, wow, I am experiencing the world of oral sounds, sonics, if you will.
Sure. Okay.
And then sometimes I choose to listen to music too. I'll whip out my fantastic iPhone 15 Pro and hit up one of my various music apps, whether it be Apple Music or a video on YouTube, because it is not available any other way. And I have to keep my phone open looking at the screen so that it won't turn off. So I listen to music very often. Very often.
All right, cool. I think for the purpose of this show, we'll probably focus on the more like deliberate action of listening to music as opposed to the accidental busker.
Fair enough. That's an easier way for me to talk about it as well.
You can't
Shazam a guy on the street to find out what song he's playing.
And God knows I've tried.
I've tried, man. Just clean it up a little bit, brother. Just holding it right up to his fiddle.
Okay, perfect. So when you are listening to music, are you trying to find new music at the moment, or do you go back to old familiar? What's the typical go-to for you?
Well, as you'll see from my playlist that I sent you, I listen to no new music, basically. I don't know the last new album that I bought that wasn't from a band that I already liked or something. I don't know. I'm not a top 40 guy ever in my life, except for I worked at a record store for like 2 years when I first started doing stand-up, but it was like it would be kind of like HMV, I would say. So it's like pretty shit, like it was shit, and it was for people that didn't know how to download stuff, so it was like such a crap job. I was so depressed. So there I was listening to, like, you know, it was when 1989 by Taylor Swift came out. I remember buying the deluxe edition of that on CD, and I think that was the last new album I bought. So 10 years ago, basically.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. How have you sort of built up that, like, the your music then over time? Is it, like, I know obviously a lot of this will be sort of soundtrack based, but is that typically the go-to, or how have you typically found it in the past?
Well, I would say I do explore a little bit, but it's more my parents were very into music. My dad is like a multi-instrumental musician. And he was in bands and stuff. He loves everything. Like, he loves folk music, he loves country music, He loves, both my parents love world music. He loves jazz. My dad loves jazz. So I have a big affinity for jazz as well. Okay. And my mom was very into British Invasion. Like, she loved Beatles. She loves Rolling Stones, my mom.
Okay.
And then also a lot of like soul, Motown, and reggae. My mum's a big reggae fan, and I absolutely fucking love reggae. I love world music. I love like African music and like Cuban music. So it's a lot of like exploration for me in that sense. Yeah. Not dissimilar to the way I explore film, which is kind of like trying to find stuff from around the world, things that sound both familiar and unfamiliar. But like, I guess I have a sound that I like, which is kind of, I like a lot of soul. I like a lot of jazz. I like a lot of reggae sounds.
Yeah.
I like a lot of like Spanishy kind of music, and then like folk music from around the world.
Okay. Grand. It's interesting because the reason I asked is probably exactly that reason, is that, you know, you say obviously that you've not discovered new music or not really listened to like top 40 stuff or anything that recent. But I would also say, like, your list is quite eclectic in terms of, like, you know, it comes from a range of different countries, for one. There's a few different genres covered here. So it's not like someone who's just locked into a taste at one point in their life and then just stuck with that forever. It's, there's quite a lot going on, I would say.
Yeah, I think I have just broad tastes because, like, for me, it's a lot about discovery. Like, it's easier for me to talk about it as film. It's like I understand how I interact with film and how I get into film. Sure. That's like my whole life is like discovery of film and wanting to share that discovery. I think music is probably not that dissimilar, but because it's not my focus, it's not my area of study, it's harder for me to articulate it or think about it like academically the way that I think about film.
Okay. All right, cool.
Mm.
Interesting. All right. Well, look, we'll dive in. So song one is a song you fell in love with straight away. So you went for Weekend Special by Brenda and the Big Dudes.
Yeah, Brenda Fassie, man. I remember the exact moment I heard this song for the first time. Uh-huh. I was at a cultural festival in Western Sydney, which is like a very diverse like area, and it was like an African cultural night called Jollof Wars, where it was all the African African nations represented like in the community. They each were making jollof rice, which is like a speciality rice dish all across Africa, and each nation was showing their unique one, and everyone would be tasting, and you're meant to pick which one is your favorite and all that stuff. Nice. It was one of the most exciting, fun nights of my life because I love food as well. I love experiencing foods from all over the world.
Yeah.
And it was just like, so it was such a rich evening, and the DJ was playing like all this African music, and it was like lots of like African soul, R&B and pop. And I heard this song and I was like, what is this? It sounded so much like the stuff that I love. And so vibrant and so upbeat. I like a lot of upbeat music, a lot of music that feels quite happy or that's like kind of fun to listen to at a party or something. And from there, I went to the DJ. I was like, what is this, man? What is this? And he told me about Brenda Fassie, and I became so fascinated by her. She is South African musician, probably their equivalent of Madonna. Like, she is or was megastar. She was so famous, huge megastar. She passed away quite some time ago now. And there's a great documentary about her as well that I watched on like Vimeo. I had to like find a private link on just the filmmaker's website. It was like a great feature length doco as well. But Brenda Fassie, man. Like, I became a huge fan of her instantly and like have listened to most of her albums by now. But this is just the track that I think of. I probably listen to it every day because it's just one of those like happy, feel good songs as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great song. I hadn't come across it before. Brenda and the Big Dudes is a great band name. First of all,
great band name. Yeah,
the Big Dudes, awesome.
Big Dudes, dude. Everyone loves dudes, and no matter the size, but if they're big, honey, that is exciting.
She's had so many albums. She's done seven different albums, or sorry, five albums and two EPs with the Big Dudes, and then a long list of solo albums as well.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, very cool. I think she's someone who's worth exploring, like, especially if you want to get into world music. Like, I think that there is something, like, that sounds familiar about these, but then also a lot of it is in, like, a language other than English as well. I think it's, like, a really good, easy access point. Like, the same kind of way that, for me, like, an access point to world music growing up was Buena Vista Social Club, like, Cuban music. Mm-hmm. Through that film. And so I think that there's some kind of like connection between the familiarity in like a genre sense, and because that's something you just understand, but then like experiencing new feelings and new sounds through it.
Perfect. I'm also very excited about the idea of a Joloff war.
Because
they're all very like, each individual country is very passionate about their own version, aren't they? So
there was a lot of passion. There was a lot of passion on this evening, and a lot of excitement. And you know, no matter who won the war, I think I was the true victor that day, because I sampled many different rices from around the Africa that were delicious, and so many delicious cuisines. It was like, it only happened once, and I think about that night so often, because it was so it was such a fun night, so rich of food and culture. Yeah. And I think when I listen to Weekend Special, Brenda Fassi, I think about that night and like what a great time it was.
That's nice. Excellent. All right, perfect. Song two is a song that took you a while. So you went for Don't Box Me In by Stuart Copeland.
Yeah. This was probably the hardest one for me to pick, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Because I think I'm not the kind of person that will persist with music the way that will persist with film, of like, if I'm not into it, like, will I go back to it, will I explore it? It like takes me, I don't know, I'm just, because it's not my I don't know, it's weird. Like, and I have artists I love, and there'll be songs I don't like by them, and they'll play every now and then, and I go, well, I guess I like it a little bit. But I think the way that accessed this question, the only way I could kind of come to it, was this is a song from a soundtrack. Like, this is from a score as well. Stuart Copeland, who was the drummer for The Police, did this incredible percussive soundtrack for the Francis Ford Coppola film Rumblefish. I remember seeing Rumblefish when I was a teenager, and I had read the book, I'd read The Outsiders, and I'd seen The Outsiders. And I think Rumblefish is such a different artistic film, and Coppola's whole, like, goal with it was to make an art film or an art house film for teenagers. And I think when I first saw it, the soundtrack was the thing that I bounced off the most, because I just thought it was, it's odd. Like, it's an odd soundtrack. It's really percussive, and it's not so, it's rhythmic, but it's not melodious. And that's kind of like the way the film feels as well. I think it was just something I never really got until a few years ago when I revisited the film, and I absolutely fell in love with the whole film head over heels, like, to the point where, and this might sound crazy, it is maybe my favorite Francis Ford Coppola film, which is psycho to say about a guy that made The Godfather, Apocalypse Now, The Godfather Part 2, The Conversation, Bram Stoker's Dracula. I think Rumblefish might be the film that I love deepest from him, because it's such an interesting expression of art. And the score is now the thing that I love the most about the film. I have this score on two vinyls. I bought one on eBay because I was hunting for it. And then I was in a vinyl store and I saw it in there. I go, well, I have to buy it again. How rare is this? And I found this. And I have an actual vintage 1980s poster of it, like, framed in my living room, like a huge poster.
Oh, wow.
I just think it's one of the most freaking wicked scores, like, ever, because it's just so weird and so strange. Had you heard it or seen the movie before?
No, I hadn't. But I read into it, and it's like, it's really interesting the way it's put together. So, because his initial role, Stuart Copeland's initial role in coming on board with the film, was to be, I think he said, like, a rhythmist or something. Like, it was literally just to provide, like, a bit of guidance in terms of how the rhythm of the soundtrack would be, and Coppola was going to score it himself, and then eventually was like, actually, do you know what, you're, you know, a professional musician, you're probably better at this, and you should maybe do it, and then did it. But did you read about MuSync, the sort of the mechanics of how he was putting this together?
Oh, I've seen like a documentary about it years and years ago, but
so there's
Wash Me in it.
There's basically a computer program that they're using to score it, where you would have the film led out, and then there were specific dots or points for particular lines of dialogue, and you could basically take a point in a scene and another point in a scene, and then basically decide how many bars you want to put in that time, and then it would sort of put together the sort of the time signature or like the BPM for that moment. So it's very much like the film first, and then the score is like very much like it's a particular rhythm that is applied to that particular moment in the film. I thought that was really interesting, and then I read as well that I haven't seen the film, but there's a lot of this sort of like there's big clocks in a lot of the scenes, and there's a theme of like time running out, and then when you listen to it again, you can you pick up on the music has a lot of that sort of like metronome kind of sound or like clocks ticking, and like at the very start of this song, which I hadn't noticed before, there's a very definite ticking as well.
Really, it's a really interesting score, and the film like speaks to that as well, because like the film does have this feeling of like temporalness, like it's like the passage of time, not over a long time, but you see you see time escaping. Like there's lots of like these B-roll cityscapes that populate a lot of the film. They were like inspired, I think they wanted Godfrey Reggio, who's like an interesting filmmaker, does like documentary factual films about cityscapes and stuff. He did like Kyanis Kutsi. I think they asked him to do it and then he didn't do it, but it's definitely inspired by that kind of like feeling of just seeing like this really small town. I think it's like in Oklahoma or something, and you're seeing it's just like you're seeing all this weird like cityscape and like urban decay and stuff. It's just I think it's such a incredible film, especially for young people. I recommend it because I think it's like it's art made for teenagers, and I think the more people that are exposed to that kind of stuff, they'll have a richer life for it, richer artistic life.
Excellent. I think it's a great one for that category thing, because it does, it very much fits the brief of it's a different approach to it, but that's typically what I have in mind is, you know, something that you've had to like stick with or come back to at a later date, and then you appreciate it from a slightly different angle.
Brother, it took me almost 10 years, I'd say, to get to it.
But I also get what you mean in terms of like the way you approach music, because I would imagine that's partially to do with the way that you approach film. Because I'm probably the reverse quite a lot of the times. That like the way I approach music, particularly for this show, is that I have to approach it from a very open mind. I have to try and like think about things that I like versus what I don't like. There's a lot of sort of research, so it's a different type of music listening compared to just like sitting back with a song that I enjoy. And I feel like that has influenced actually how I view TV and film. Is that quite a lot of the time I'm not watching something on TV to challenge me in any way, or to like, you know, I'm kind of looking for something that it'll just be like something that's familiar to me, or something that I know is going to be fairly like easy watching.
Yeah, it's kind of spot on. Like I don't really often listen to music to be challenged. I can't really, it's not how I get into it, to the point where I'm like, I'm the kind of person that if I find a song I like, I'm listening to it nonstop. Like I'll be like hitting it, and to the point where I'm going, God, I love this song. I might just start listening to it again while I'm still listening to it. Like I'll skip back to the start of a song halfway through a song, because I'm like, oh, I love the act of listening to this song so much that I do that very, very often. Like that's almost an everyday occurrence for me.
Yeah, sure. Okay, good. All right, song three is the song from your introduction to music. So you went for New Jack Hustler by Ice-T.
Yeah, I think because my parents were like, so my dad in particular is so musical that when it came to like finding my own taste in music, there is probably that spark of rebellion where I was like, well, I don't want it to be what these guys listen to.
Sure.
And so when my dad like gave me money and took me to a record store to like go, hey, you can buy anything you want. What do you want your first album to be, like with your own money? Like I had like, when I say my own money, I was like probably 11 years old, and it was like, you know, It was like my, what do you call that? When you allowance, like my allowance for my
parents.
Your
pocket money? Yeah.
My pocket money. But it was my parents would rent a section of my wardrobe. Because I had tiny clothes because I was a little boy and they had heaps of clothes. So they would pay me like $5 a week rent for using my wardrobe.
That's great.
Yeah. So I'd saved enough and my dad was like, I'll give you the rest. You can buy any CD you want. So I'm like, going around a record store, wandering around, and I see this Ice-T album. And it would have been like the 10th anniversary of this album, I think. Like it would have something like that. Like that's why there was like a reissue.
Okay.
And I knew what a gangster was because the album's called Ice-T OG Original Gangster. I knew what gangster was. And I was like, gangster is cool in my head. I was like, gangster is cool. Crime is cool. I want to be a gangster one day or something. Yeah. And then I just go like, I want to get this. It said mature audiences. So there was like this like nastiness to it. Because my parents have promised, like, it can be whatever you want. And my parents, like, you know, chill progressives. So they're kind of like, let him experience what he wants as well to some degree. So I got this album. I just loved it so straight away because it was adult. And so, like, you know, it's like Ice-T, he speaks from the streets. And I found, like, that so interesting. Like, it's so urban. I grew up in, like, a big city. So it's like, you know, that urban, like, stuff speaks to me as well. Mm-hmm. And I became obsessed with Ice-T to a point where, to this day, he's one of my biggest heroes. I've read, like, his books. I've seen every movie that he's been in. I've been watching Law & Order SVU my entire life, basically. But I just love him, and I love his music, and I love, like, his street poetry and stuff. Mm. And this album in particular was, like, such a door opening into gangster rap and, like, West Coast rap. And I think not too long after that, he made this compilation CD, which was two discs called Ice-T Presents West Side. And it was him making a mixtape of his favorite and most influential West Coast rappers and rap squads and stuff. And so that was like a big introduction to me into this world. And at the end of each CD, there was like a 15-minute interview with him where he was talking through the music, talking through like biographical history of the area. Like, he was basically, like, like a historian, like an oral history. It was interesting and so cool. And that's, like, how I discovered stuff like Jurassic 5, E-40, a lot of, like, gangster rap and West Coast rap, like, Nate Dogg, Tupac. MC Hammer is someone that he talks about with such reverence, and it, like, I've always thought of MC Hammer as, like, one of the great masters because Ice-T talked about it when I was 12 years old. So, like, most of my life, I've been like, MC Hammer is a king and he's a god amongst men.
Right, okay. Excellent. Excellent. It's such a punt, I think, to go for that based on little to no information.
It was just a guy in a wife beater, like in a singlet tank top. I was like, that looks awesome. I should get that CD.
It's very early 90s, the album cover, but like it is cool. I can see why that would appeal to
a 12-year-old
child.
Boy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Have you I'm going to ask this question knowing the answer is of course you have, but the film New Jack City?
Great film. So I think it is for that film. Like he made this song, like in conjunction with that film. But it is. It's great. Like that kind of, urban gangster drug dealer kind of epic. Great movie. Really fun.
Okay, excellent. Alrighty, song four. Is a song that makes you happy. So you went for Dolce Vita by Ryan Paris.
Yeah, I like Italo Disco, you know. I think Italo Disco is really fun. And this is the one in particular I really like. That Italo Disco feeling, it's just like, you know, feels like a freaking summer day. It's kind of relaxing, but it's also like upbeat and jovial. And there's something about this one, you know, about the sweet life. And I guess I associate with the Fellini film as well, because they have the same title. And I'm like, okay, I like that.
Yeah, yeah. I think that was the inspiration for it, I'm sure. He was someone like told him he should write a song inspired by the title of that film. And he went, he began to work on it right away, starting with the bass line on his mini Moog, which is do you know what a mini Moog?
It's like a little keyboard, right?
Yeah, it's like a little synthesizer, a little analog synthesizer. Really cool looking, really sweet little device. So I've actually had this song on the show before. It's a great song. It's really fun. My only thing that I brought up before is like the version that I've listened to is like 7.5 minutes long, and I'm kind of like, I probably got what I need after 2.5. You know,
there's a 3-minute version that out there. That's where I first heard it, and I couldn't find it to send to you. And there's like a breakdown in this version where I'm like, oh, shut up, man. And that is a case of me skipping back to the start of a song that I like so much because I'm like, I'm sick of this breakdown, man. Get me to the good stuff. I want to hear the fun bits.
Yeah, it is lovely though, and I think I'm the same in terms of like I always find it interesting how people interpret just the notion of happy when it comes to music. Mm. So this is a lot more. This isn't your sort of like walking on sunshine kind of music. This is a lot more chilled energy, kind of like blissful kind of feel into it.
Yeah.
But it's just really nice. It just sits in a nice place in my brain that I'm just like, yeah, everything's all right. Everything's pretty cool for the next like 7 minutes or, you know, however long.
Yeah. 3 minutes, then a weird part, and then another good 2 minutes, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of what happiness is to me.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, it's like, you could see this, like, playing in a bar. If you're having some drinks with some buddies, maybe you're going out on the patio to have a little durry or two. There's something about it, it's like, it feels like a good social song.
Yeah.
Or, you know, a good song wandering around the city, which is my other favorite thing to do. I'm a pedestrian. I love walking. I love walking around the city, and I love grooving to music while I do it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice. I think he had a great line where he talked about it when someone had written the song for him. He said, "When I heard the song, I really made a big jump because it was very nice."
Mm.
I think it's obviously English isn't his first language, but it's very sweet. I really like that.
He's bang on the money. He's a great communicator.
Yeah, I really made a big jump because it was very nice.
It is very nice. Yeah. It is very nice. So I think he's accurate.
Yeah. He's not wrong. All right. Song 5 is a song that makes you sad. So we went for...
Do you want me to say it?
No.
Yeah.
Let me try it. I can never remember if it's Mu or Mo.
Mimo.
Mimo Thimonis Matiamo.
By George
Dalaras.
Yeah, George Dalaras. Mimo Thimonis Matiamo. Yeah,
it sounds nicer when you say it, to be fair, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. It is my mother tongue, if you will. This is a Greek song. George Dalaras, like a really famous Greek musician. Mm-hmm. And he starts coming up in the 1960s when he's like 19 years old. And he pairs with a very beloved and extremely significant songwriter. Mm-hmm. What's his name? Sonis maybe, and this is like one of their biggest songs together, and it's kind of like this rebetiko music, which is like Greek folk music. And this song, it's like about a man, Mimou Thimonis Matiamou, roughly, or the approximation translation is don't be angry at me, my love. Mm-hmm. Or don't be angry, my love. But Matiamou is like it's a sweet term in Greek, like it's a term of endearment or affection, which is the literal translation is my eyes. Mm-hmm. Like it's like that you call someone my eyes, but it's more the poetic translation is my love. Mm-hmm. And this song is about a man who is going to leave for foreign land for either war or for migration. And he doesn't want his lover to be angry at him for leaving. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like a sorrowful, mournful, like tragic song, but it's also just like really, really beautiful. And it's used in a movie, Australian film, that's very important to me, called Head On, by Anna Kokkinos, which is about the Greek diaspora in Australia, in Melbourne. And it's like a coming of age film of a a man who is struggling with like his sexual identity, his Greek cultural identity, his masculinity, and it's like this kind of thing that to me it's like one of those films that speaks a lot deep to me because it's like very specific perspective that just one of my favorite movies, and it's used in like a beautiful scene of like cultural connection between him and his father, of like displaying disconnect and cultural connection. But this is like it's a beautiful song.
I was reading into it. The guy that he linked in with, was it Stavros?
Stavros Kouyoumidzis.
There we go.
Yes, you're right. It is Stavros Kouyoumidzis, a Greek composer and writer. Yeah. Perfect. He is from the same like age. Stavros Kouyoumidzis, same age as my grandfather, my papu, and they're from the same part of the world. They're both born in Asia Minor, which is a country that doesn't exist anymore, and both migrated to Thessaloniki. Well, migrated, they were forced to, they were refugees in Thessaloniki. And so he's I think that's where the connection to me comes from as well, in my family, with like liking this kind of rebetiko music and this rebetiko revival of like the 70s, 60s and 70s when this song comes out.
Yeah, it's a beautiful song. Like I did some reading up into the song, and I'd read that phrase that "Don't be angry at me" in the translation of "My eyes," which I really like. And obviously, you know, Greek language is very good for that, of having, you know, very distinctive phraseology for particular feelings and emotions. And "My eyes" is a really beautiful sentiment when you have the context that it's for love. But yeah, it's interesting. Like, when I was reading into it, it seems to be like there's quite a common theme of immigration, or like, you know, leaving a country, because there were so many Greeks that left during the 50s and 60s to...
Yeah, during the junta.
To find a better life. And yeah, it's a gorgeous song in that context, because like, you know, there's quite a lot of... It's obviously going to be a sort of conflicting set of emotions there, of like, you know, like trying to create a better life for yourself and for your family, but also having this kind of this connection to, you know, the homeland.
I mean, that's something that's very important to me. Like, it's so essential to who I am, is that like, you know, that is my Greekness and my heritage. But also, I haven't been back to Greece since I was like 5 years old. Like, we lived there when I was for a year when I was like five.
Right,
I've not been back since, because it's so expensive to travel anywhere from Australia.
Yeah,
and I'm a poor film critic, comedian, documentarian. It's like, you know, I didn't pick big money jobs that would keep me employed all year round.
Yeah,
so it's like, oh, that's what I miss out on. It's like I haven't been back to my motherland for a long time. Yeah. So like listening to music like this, it makes me feel a lot of feelings.
Right, I got you. Yeah,
some of those sad and melancholy.
And then the following line is, "I will turn into a bird and I will come back again to you," which, again, gorgeous.
Beautiful poetry.
Yeah.
And I think it's literal. He literally meant it. He was going to transform. He was going to... There's a second verse that's not in the version I sent you where he goes to seek a witch to transform him into a bird.
Wait, actually, really?
No.
Oh, okay, cool.
No. No. But if I were making the song, I would include that. I was like, we need literal interpretation. I am seeking a witch to transfigure me into a creature of the sky so I can fly back to you, babe.
This is what I mean about having to have an open mind with music, because like in any other context, I'd be like, shut the fuck up. That's a ridiculous thing to say. But no, I'm like, I can see that working. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. It's definitely interesting. Not many other songs. They're like, "I'm like a bird." No, I am literally a bird. Now, what I want to do.
Oh god! Right. I think you need to do what Adam Sandler does and just like create a project that means that you have to go to Greece.
Hey, check this out.
I saw him. Yeah, there he is.
Yeah. I got an Adam Sandler cutout behind my head right here. Yeah, I am trying to do exactly that. I'm trying to go, well, can I get something made in Greece? Can I do that?
Yeah. Absolutely. It needs to be done. Right. Song 6 is a song to relax to. So you went for Rebel Music. So this is Bob Marley and the Wailers, but this is the Bill Laswell remix.
Yeah, this is really cool. This is like an experimental album by Bill Laswell, who was like a bassist and producer. And he was not really that familiar with like Bob Marley, but he made this like concept album called Dreams of Freedom, ambient translations of Bob Marley. And it's basically creating like these musical soundscapes using all these recorded sounds from Bob Marley to kind of like atmospherically put you in Kingston, to put you in Jamaica, using the sounds of Bob Marley. But the main thing that's missing is his voice. There's no Bob Marley voice. There's like remnants of it that you can hear from like other, like in the midst of other recordings, other sound encapsulations. You might hear like remnants of it. And it's kind of interesting because like it's almost like evoking the soul without using the voice. Like you've taken something away, yet it is still there. Yeah. And it's like this track is like 10 minutes long. And I love this album so much. A sound designer, teacher of mine, Andrew Belletti, an incredible sound designer, he introduced this to me, this album, like over 10 years ago now. And it's just always been with me. And I used to, I've not done this for a long time, but I remember when I first got into this song, my friends came over and we got extremely high and we watched like a nature documentary with the sound off while listening to this. And
wow,
we're just
okay,
like,
yeah.
Oh, brother, this is bliss, man. We're relaxed as hell. And whenever I want to relax, I listen to this like on speakers, lying down. And I just, I think it's a very beautiful album.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really, really interesting. And I read up then on dub music as a genre, because I'd not come across it before, and it's basically what this is. Dub music is like, it's a sort of a subgenre of reggae, or it's come out of reggae, where it's essentially they've taken reggae music, you strip the vocal out of it, you put more emphasis on the percussion, and then you add like echo and reverb to certain elements of the song as well. And
it kind of evolves into like dubstep, which was like, you know, a big genre of music when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And I was like, I always liked dubstep, but I prefer dub.
Yeah. And you can see how it sort of made that transition, because it does have that sort of almost like psychedelic quality to it, as well as being like, it is very ambient, very relaxing. It's beautiful. But yeah, I was reading up on it. Like, dub music was like created by accident. I don't know if you knew this or if you'd seen this before.
I didn't know this. Yeah, tell me.
So it was in the late 60s. Ruddy Redwood, who was a sound system operator, he went to cut off a dub plate for one of the songs, and the engineer left the vocal track off by accident. But this sort of stems from like when like playing music live was a much bigger part of the culture. So he had this track that he had basically, the vocal track was cut off by accident. He played it anyway, and people really loved it. So he had his DJ doing a thing called toasting, which is essentially just talking over the song. But
yeah, it's like the first rapping.
Yeah, yeah. But people really enjoyed it because, like, I think, I don't know if it's a sort of a thought process where people like subconsciously need to fill in the blank, but it was recognizable to them to the point where they needed to sing along, and it got a lot of people really excited. And straight away, there were other producers being like, "We need to be doing this. We need to be creating this music."
Yeah.
And it sort of just evolved and grew from there. Which is really interesting. And then, I was also reading about like dub plates, which is like a sort of a precursor to the vinyl record, which is, I think there were different like cutting houses where people could go and get these like created made off the like digital off like cassette tapes essentially.
Yeah.
And then they would be able, I think it was because it had to be like really quick, so they would make a track, and then they wanted to play it that weekend, so they'd go to these cutting houses and have it cut to this acetate disc, and then they would be able to play it live at their next performance and stuff. It just sent me down this road of this. It's just really interesting.
Yeah,
the whole thing. But the
all right, man.
Yeah, but the track is class, and I don't know if it. I don't know if there's initially when I heard it, I was like, is this kind of like, is this something slightly sacrilegious about an American taking Bob Marley's music and taking Bob Marley out of it? Like, is there some controversy here? But like, I don't know. It's good. I like it.
Yeah, I think it's because it's a holistic like art experiment. I think if you like, I understand exactly that, but I'm like, oh, but he achieved something with this. So it's kind of like, how can it be sacrilege if you create something powerful? Mm. And the whole album is beautiful. It's a great album to relax to. Maybe when you've got your new bub in your arms, you can lay back and drift off to this album together.
Yeah, 100%. I'll check it out. All right, song 7 is a song from your preteen years. So you went for Say You'll Be There by Spice Girls.
I love the Spice Girls. They were my first obsession when I was a child. I love them, and I still absolutely adore this song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's fun, man. It's fun. It's got like that kind of like Motown Stax Records kind of like boppiness to it. Yeah. But it's also like got like, it's just, I think it's instrumentally, it's really fun and interesting. And I love all the vocals on it. Like, I like, they're just such a good girl band. I mean, they're the best girl band, like, of our lifetime, I would say.
Yeah.
And it persists for me, this song. It persists. I still love it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a great era of pop music. Like, I was quite into Spice Girls and, like, S Club 7, who maybe aren't quite as
I still love them, too, you know?
Yeah. But I was into a lot more pop music, and then as I got into my teenage years, I got a lot more cynical with pop music and got into like more guitar based stuff and got to a point where I basically like completely dismissed pop as a genre.
Yes.
So it's quite nice to revisit songs like this and actually like properly listen to them and enjoy like the composition and how many complex elements there are to it. And like pop music at this time was also like a bit batshit. Like there were some things that you just would not try now. Like there's a harmonica solo in this.
Yeah, which is it's like, crazy.
Which I also I read about that. The guy who plays the harmonica solo, his other big harmonica credit on a song is Karma Chameleon.
Which is great.
Yeah.
That's wicked, man.
Isn't that good?
That's awesome.
Yeah. Imagine being the harmonica player on Karma Chameleon. And then you're on a Spice Girls song. Amazing.
That's it. Then you can retire, man. You don't need anything else.
Yeah, you're done.
You don't need to become Bob Dylan, brother. You've done two of the most iconic harmonica bits ever. Bob Dylan wants to be you, man.
Yeah, 100%. Great song, man. All right, song 8 is a cover. So you went for La Vie en Rose by Grace Jones.
I love Grace Jones. Always love Grace Jones. I always love Edith Piaf as well. Edith Piaf is a big musician for me in my life. Okay. And La Vie en Rose, of course, is like one of her signature songs. Yeah. The first time I heard this song was in the Pedro Almodóvar film Pain and Glory, starring Antonio Banderas from 2019. And instantly, it became one of my favorite songs, this cover version of it. So this song plays a lot in my life, especially around that time, because I cook a lot and I listen to a lot of music when I cook. And this, for some reason, became like the song that I wanted to listen to the most while I was cooking. And so it's just always lived with me. And I think because it's like a slow building song, like La Vie en Rose, it's a powerful song, but Grace Jones, it's like so much about like this kind of like percussive rhythmic instrumental that begins it before her vocals even start. And it's almost like there's so much character to this version that I just really love. Had you heard this cover before?
I feel like I might have. I don't think I'd properly given it a listen. It felt familiar to me, but it wasn't one that was like, oh yeah, of course, I know that one. It's gorgeous though. It's there are certain songs that I listen to, and again, this sort of goes back to what I was saying about, you know, the level of concentration that I have with certain songs. This feels like a song that I had to like take a little bit of time over. There are certain
songs. It's long. It's like 7 minutes, this cover. Yeah. I gave you a lot of long songs, man. I gave you a lot of long songs.
A lot of homework.
Should have been sending you some radio edits, man. Should be typing a radio edit after I put a song in for you.
No, it's all good. But it is a song that, like, you know, if I'm in the middle of doing something, like, I listen to music when I'm, like, I don't know, cleaning the kitchen or, like, you know, just doing stuff around the house. There are certain songs that I will have in a list that will be like, okay, this is my sitting down and just listening to this song for a moment song. So it was definitely one of those. And it gets really kind of like urgent and passionate towards the end as well, which is like, it's a fascinating piece of music.
She is such an interesting artist and like just a cool person that lives as art, Grace Jones.
Yeah.
I remember I saw her live. She came to Australia a few years ago. Maybe it would have been around the same time that I was listening to this song.
Uh-huh.
She came to Australia for like this music festival that was like a 1 day or 1 weekend festival in Sydney, so you didn't have to travel to it. I'm not a music festival guy, like I've never been one. And I was like, oh, I almost even went to another city to just go see her in concert, but somehow one of my friends gave me a ticket to this music festival
because
he knew that I wanted to see Grace Jones. He's like, hey, I've got an extra ticket. You can take it. So I went to only see one act, and then I walked past like Phoenix or Beck, and I was like, that's it. I'm done. I went to go see Grace Jones, went and saw a little bit of Beck. I'm like, okay, awesome. I can just go straight home. And it was like a dream come true.
That's good. Like, so it's like the guy who plays the harmonica on Karma Chameleon. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you've smashed it and you can go.
Yeah.
Sometimes you've done what you've set out to do, and then you leave it there.
Exactly. I know what I want.
Yeah.
I know what I want. I know how to get it. A friend gave me a free ticket.
That's a lesson for anyone who wants to. Yeah. Anyone who really wants to succeed in life.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way to do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. Get that ticket.
Song 9 is a song you would sing karaoke. So you're going for Summer Nights by John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John.
From the Grease soundtrack. Another song from Grease. But it's different spelling, if you will.
I will.
I will, thank you. I mean, it's not... You don't have to look very hard into who I am to discover, like, John Travolta is a personal hero of mine and someone I'm obsessed over.
Sure.
And I love this movie. I love Grease. I love the Grease soundtrack. It's probably my favorite musical. And it is the song that I probably sung at karaoke the most. Like, just go get one of my buddies, come do a duet with me, let's sing Grease. And it's so participatory, you know? Like, everyone's like, tell me more. They're having fun. Mm-hmm. Everyone's having fun with that song, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Is there... So, is it purely just the fun energy of the song? Because I know some people have picked like duets before because there's a little added security blanket there for people who are not maybe big fans of karaoke, but
I like karaoke, but I'm not a big singer. I'm not a singer, and I don't know the lyrics to like any songs. I don't know the lyrics don't stick in my head. The only song I know the lyrics to is My Sweet Lord by George Harrison because it's like 5 words like over and over again.
Okay, sure.
And then Tequila, obviously, because that's 1 word over and over again.
Yeah,
and then the Golden Girls theme song because I watched that show like so much growing up. So I just know like Thank You for Being a Friend, like to the word. So... But this is like, you know, the lyrics are on the screen. I kind of know Summer Lovin' had me a blast. And it's like, you know, it's kind of a little bit in my range. It's fun to sing with someone else. Everyone knows the song. Yeah, it's fun. There was a great karaoke bar in Sydney that closed down during COVID called Ding Dang Dong. And it was like, it was a dream come true. And it was like right around the corner from this comedy show I used to run for years. We would go after that very often, like me and a bunch of our comedy friends just being like, let's go sing some karaoke, Ding Dang Dong. And then you could also ask them on the screens where they have like the lyrics and stuff. You know, have music videos of like usually like, you know, Island Paradises and stuff like that.
There
you could ask them to put softcore pornography. They had like a secret channel that had softcore pornography on. So with the lyrics on as well, and we would always do that because it's just like a little extra naughtiness, you know.
Cool. All right. Well, those summer nights. Yeah, okay.
And it's fun to go, nah, at the end. Like, everyone loves to do that.
That is
nah.
Good.
You can do whatever you want in that note. You can do it however you please.
Yeah, yeah. Alu, you just sang it perfectly, so...
Yes, it's a very forgiving song.
Yeah, absolutely. Song 10 is a song that reminds you of a specific place, so you've gone for Whip It by Devo.
Yeah, by Devo. This is like a new wave classic, and I'll tell you, because it's hard to go, a song that reminds you of a place without it going, well, it reminds you of a time and a place, because it's like in your memory, it's how the place was when you were there. So this was a song that makes me think of my high school, Blackwattle Bay, in Sydney's Glebe on the foreshore area, right next to the fish markets. Because with the teachers and stuff in our final year in year 12, they're like, you need to pick like a school, like a song for your year, like that will represent your year. And we kind of knew from the past that they were like, oh, you have to, the song will be then incorporated into like, the lyrics were used in like messaging and stuff from the school. And we were like, that's so lame. And so one of my D friends, Kynan, like set up like a, you know, an initiative, like almost a campaign to make it Whip It by Devo because it's got like ridiculous lyrics. And the teachers also thought that was really funny and they had a fun time making the lyrics, like be like, you know, like motivational stuff. So it was like, it played constantly at our school and, it was like, it's just a song that whenever I listen to it, I think about being, you know, 17 years old with my life ahead of me.
Yeah.
Yet to be crushed by my dreams and aspirations.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That's so funny. It's particularly funny given like the lyrics are almost like written to be exactly that. It's complete nonsense, but it's because I was reading that it's intended to satirize like American optimism and
he's
also taking inspiration from like communist propaganda posters.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, you got these really like these out of context motivational cliches and then you can just solve all your problems by whipping it.
Yes, exactly.
Whatever that means.
Whatever that means, but they utilized it well. They utilized it on their own propaganda in my school. And I would say, like, my school was probably very... It was in an area of Sydney that's, like, a progressive bubble. Right. So it was, like, probably we all our parents were, like, socialists and stuff. So it was, like, you know, maybe that's part of it, too. I'm like, yeah, this is awesome. We love the messaging in this song.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the band members also said it was, like... They wrote it as like formal a form of a subtle pep talk to Jimmy Carter when he was running against Ronald Reagan. Yeah, so again that makes sense if it, you know, for a socialist area to buy into that. But yeah, it's great. I think initially when I was listening to it, I was like, "What is this?" And then when I read it was nonsense, I was like, "Okay, great, I'm on board then. Fine."
Mm-hmm. We love that nonsense. We love nonsense. This,
yeah. Mm-hmm. As long as I know, if I'm sitting there confused and I don't know what they're doing, I'm almost a little bit angry at it. And then if I'm okay, now I'm in on the joke. But yeah, it's amazing. It's so funny.
Yeah, it felt very fun. It felt very silly.
Yeah, definitely. All right, song 11 is a song that reminds you of a specific person. So you have gone for Jamaica by Giannis Kalatsis.
Yeah, Jamaica by Giannis Kalatsis. This is like it's a cover by him. It's kind of like a Greek folk song. And it reminds me of my mother and my grandfather, my yaya. Reminds me of my family. Because like the previous Greek rebetiko song, this is more of a hopeful song as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's about, it's like a song for the proletariat, if you will, where it's like it's a song about like people working, and working, but they have dreams of one day using their earnings to go on a holiday to Jamaica. And like, that's like the far off dream for them. And so this was a song my mum introduced me to when I was a teenager. And this version of the song, too, by Giannis Kalatsis, And it's always meant a lot to me, this song, always, because it's just like, you know, those dreams of, you know, whatever, it may be hard, but there's always some beauty, or there's somewhere, there's something to hope for, there's something to long for. And, you know, I would love to go to Jamaica myself one day.
Yeah. Again, you need Adam Sandler.
Absolutely. That one, that's an easier one to Adam Sandler, perhaps.
Yeah, that's more his wheelhouse for sure.
Exactly.
When you say she introduced you to it, then, so what did that actually look like? Was that, you know, is this a song that she played a lot, or what's...
Yeah, she gave me a CD specifically when I was a teenager, because I was trying to get into more Greek music as well.
Oh, yeah.
This was on a CD, like a mixtape CD, like a compilation of like Greek music. And this was the track that I loved the most, because it's like quite upbeat.
Yeah.
And it kind of like has like, it's danceable, like it's, you can Greek dance to this song.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, but it's a very hopeful song, But it's also like, you know, there's some tragedy involved as well. But it's like, I just love it. Love this song. It makes me think of my family.
Yeah, beautiful. Would you still listen to it often?
Yes, still listen to it often.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is a beautiful song.
It's in a lot of my playlists, this one. A lot of my playlists, this song.
Yeah, I can see that. All right, perfect. Song 12 is a song that motivates you. So you went for Bloody Shadows from Afar by Lina Platonos.
Yeah, Lina Platonos. She is a Greek electronic musician from the 1980s. She's still active today. She still makes music today. She makes like these club bangers with like this other Greek DJ called Die Architect. And she's just, I only discovered her a few years ago, and her music is so interesting and experimental. And when I use this one, this was another hard pick for me. Like, what is something, a song that motivates me? Because I don't know if I use music for motivation very often.
Sure.
But I've been writing something for like the last year, that is darker. And Lina Platonos' music has been inspiring me a lot for the tone and all the feelings that I'm wanting to do with this.
Okay.
And the things I want to embody. And it's like a lot about like my Greekness. So it was like very quickly, I was like, oh, Lina Platonos, that's like what I want this to feel and sound like. Okay. And what I want to feel while I'm writing this, and like the kind of like genre aspect of it as well. Mm. So I listened to this a lot. This music, this album called Gallop from her a lot, with this which this song is on, and it inspires me a lot to want to write more. And it makes, when I'm listening to this music, I'm thinking about the characters and stuff, and I'm thinking about this story that I'm doing. And so like, and when I'm writing, I do listen to it. So it feels like that's the, when I'm talking about motivation at the moment, it's a song that gets my creative juices flowing in a very specific way.
Perfect. I think this is the category more than any that has, I think it has like caused people difficulties in terms of like how they read it, because I mean,
it caused
me
hardship.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. But yeah, for me initially, when I was thinking about motivating, was like I was purely just straight down the middle, was thinking like gym bangers kind of thing, like, you know, walking fast, main character energy. And then I remember I was speaking to like Mish Witchup, and she said, you know, like a gym banger doesn't motivate me to exercise; it motivates me to kill myself. Thought, well then. Yeah, we'll maybe go with a slightly different direction for some people.
Mish and I are twin souls in this world.
But yeah, I think, as I say, it's probably the category that's caused the most difficulty in terms of people's interpretation, but it's had the most interesting responses to that. And the most interesting like approaches to that. So I really, really like that answer. I really like that version of motivation, because I've spoken to a few people. Like I spoke to like Liv Hewson, who was acting in Yellow Jackets, and they were saying that they have a particular playlist to get into like a 90s mindset, but also like a sort of
character.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to have that on a, like, I'm sure other people have talked about it on a writing level as well, but it's really interesting to have that sort of a kind of particular mood, and also particular like the specific Greekness as well, as part of that is is really fascinating. So like if yeah. you're if you is it like a like do you use it as like a switch almost to get into like writing mode, or like do you have does it just sort of come to you and then you put on the music when you decide to write, or how do you like allocate that time to get into
it? It's interesting because it's a little bit of both. Like sometimes I just go, well, I feel like listening to this, and when I listen to this I start thinking about this idea, yeah. this project. Yeah. But when I am physically writing it, I put it on and it like helps me feel the tone right. that I'm wanting to strike and yeah. like the feelings. Cause I'm like, oh, this is how the way this music makes me feel is the way that I want to impart onto an audience or whatever, how I want them to feel. So it's kind of like inspiring in that sense. It's interesting. Liv talked about something like that too, because I probably learned this technique through directing. Like when I was in film school and we talk about like directing performance, a lot of the time will be like, a technique you can do is like assigning a song, to like kind of help with movement or something. Mm. Or, you know, there'd be like, there was a thing that we studied, which was like, dialogue free movement versions of like scenes. We go like, we're going to play this song that I think embodies this thing. So we're going to like kind of move through the scene with this song, and then we're going to take the song away as we keep rehearsing, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's like, that's really interesting. I had not even thought about it in that kind of sense before, but it's probably informed by that same place.
Amazing. Okay. It's actually something like, it's actually something I've thought would be such an interesting like spin off to this is to speak to people specifically about music within the creative process. Because I was so fascinated by what Liv was saying about the playlist that they have and like how that sort of gets them into that mindset. And I just thought like there must be so many, Annie Lumsden talked about it as well. Like there's a song she had that like, it was Anthony and the Johnson song. I can't remember which one exactly, but like just makes her cry straight away. So like that's the song that she uses for acting as well. But I just find the process really interesting and how the music feeds into it. So I thought about that quite a bit. So like from a writing perspective, I'm fascinated by that as well.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Like recently I did another like acting thing where I listened to like a soundtrack from a film to like kind of get more into the zone of this character that I was playing. It was like and it was also like kind of find the reality of the character, so it wouldn't just be like a broad comedic sketch type performance. It was kind of like, okay, I want to get a little bit deeper, a little bit realer with what I'm doing, like for this kind of rehearsal thing. Mm-hmm. And so like, I was like, oh, maybe this guy's a bit lonely. And so I listened to, and it was also like very on the nose for the thing that I was doing. I listened to like the score to another Francis Ford Coppola movie, The Conversation, which is like this David Shire jazz score. It's like this lonely kind of clarinet thing. Yeah. And I was like, okay, that helped me kind of zone in onto how to bring the reality to this guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. I'm pretty sure now I'm thinking about it. It was Zachary Wayne who had a similar kind of process for something that he was writing as well. I don't know if it was this exact category, but it was definitely, there was definitely a piece of music that was quite melancholic and like would very, very, I can't remember the artist now, but very, very similar to, you know, the scoring of like This Is England, that kind of energy where where you could basically show a shot of anything and you'd be like, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. You're like in This Is England, they have like just these like blocks of buildings and you're watching and you're like, God, this is romantic. Because the music feeds into it. Okay. I could probably talk about this for a while. So we'll move on. Song 13 is a song that somebody introduced you to. So you went for Gangsta Bitch by Apache.
Yeah, I love this song. I got this song from my older godbrother. He was probably like my godbrother who was that person that kind of was that cool person that you really looked up to, thought was really cool. They had cool taste. They informed your taste. And so a lot of the things are still important to me and have been important to me throughout my life are probably descended from him. So he liked a lot of like gangster rap music. Maybe that's how I found Ice-T as well.
Sure.
And like he would also love Saturday Night Live, and he had the Best of Mike Myers on VHS. So it's like actually was intrinsic into becoming who I am and like loving the kind of comedy that I love and the kind of comedy that I make. And like my comedic voice is definitely going like, wow, this guy thinks this is cool. I want to be cool. So I'm going to become Mike Myers. I think the way that I discovered this song was he gave me the CD when I was a teenager. And it's like J period and Q-Tip. Q-Tip from A Tribe Called Quest. Mm-hmm. And this album is basically, it's called The Abstract Best of J period and Q-Tip. And J period is a music producer that would basically make these almost like artistic, documentary, factual albums that utilize tracks, but he mixes them in with interview and talking head documentary aspects. So it's like an abstract album best of, like an abstract best of. You're like experiencing like who the band is and the music that's surrounding them. And Apache Gangsta Bitch was on there like as a 1 minute version when they were talking to like contemporary music that was happening in hip hop at that time. Right. It was the first time I ever heard this song. I had to like go discover the actual song. And the song is fucking cool, man, because it's like about this guy that loves like strong women and loves like assertive, strong women that have like their own like ambitions and stuff. And he's like the ride along guy for like these cool chicks. I'm like, that's fucking sick, man.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting lesson in like how different people use different language.
Yeah.
Because initially, you know, when you hear "I need a gangster bitch," you're like, "Oh, right, it's one of them."
Mm-hmm.
And then you listen to what he's talking about, and he's like, "I want a strong woman. Yeah. I want someone who can like hang with
me. I want someone with agency. I want someone with agency." It's like, it's awesome. It's a feminist anthem for relationships.
It really is. Yeah.
In gangster rap, which is very rare. It's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's like, I had a church girl, choir girl, one girl was rich. Mm-hmm. The most memorable girl was a gangster bitch.
Great line, huh?
Great. Yeah, it's so good. Yeah, if you order dough, then you have to pay. It's a fun album. Or a fun song, rather. That's cool. I like what you said about your girl brother as well.
Shout out to Slava if you're listening.
Is he much older than you?
Oh, not that much. Like maybe like 5 years or young or less. But
right.
Yeah, he was just, you know, he had great tastes. He was into video games and stuff, and you know, so it was all like, it was cool.
I reckon that's a sweet spot though, because then like when you're very young, he feels much older, and then when you get into sort of teenage years, he's not that much older. So it's still there's a little bit of a accessibility there, which is quite nice. Perfect. Yeah. Great song, though. I really liked it.
Yeah, we love gangster bitches. Me, you, and you. We love gangster bitches. That's true.
I want to agree, but like, that is the word that my wife hates more than any other.
Yeah.
Like, to the point where I've accidentally called her a bitch sometimes, and I've actually had to go, like, oh, no, I'm sorry. I meant cunt. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Yes.
And she's fine with
it. It's a word that I don't really use in my real life outside of this song, or like, you know, call a fella a bitch every now and then, but it's it's an outdated word, but it's like, this song rips, man.
Yeah, it's good. It's good, yeah. I just want to distance myself slightly from the notion that I love gangster bitches. Just
I love gangster bitches, I'll say it. Cool. I'm saying it with pride and with some shame.
Yeah. Again, the sweet spot. It's great. all right. Song 14 is a song you wouldn't expect to like. So you've gone for The Macarena by Los Del Rio.
Yeah. The version of The Macarena that everyone is thinking of.
Yes.
I mean, I guess why I expect I wouldn't like it, because it's like a novelty song from when I was a child you know, you would have heard the absolute fuck out of this song back in the younger days.
Yeah.
And yet, I listen to it heaps. I really love this song. I love the way that sounds. I like that it's got like this old, like, Spanish, you know, rhythm to it, this Spanish feeling. And that's kind of like what the Los Del Rio, they're like just a really old school band. And somehow they made a song that popped, and then they became like a DJ'd version that really popped. And it's just, it's an interesting, weird story around the song. But the song I think is awesome. I listen to it all the time. And when I'm like in the kitchen listening to it, I'm like dancing, but not the Macarena dance. I'm doing my own little dance to it. Because it's just like, it gets your ass grooving.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, I know you said like the version that that everyone's thinking of is the Bayside Boys remix, which is like you know, your classic Macarena. I think they should be very, very grateful to the Bayside Boys for that remix, because I've listened to the original. It's not it doesn't have the same magic, I think it's a good word. It doesn't have the same magic.
It's nice, like it's nice, but you need that laugh, that lady laughing is like the biggest part of the song. It's not a you need the I want to say when the boys say when I say papa the nisa papa sa papa sa ha ha ha. You need that. That's the song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You need the woman who's basically talking about, and I'm sure this is in the original as well, the woman who's cheating on her partner who's not there with two men.
Yes, exactly. This is a song that needs a gangster bitch, and they figured it out. Figured it out. This isn't the same genre. This is a gangster bitch track.
This is a gangster bitch track. It's gonna be a separate genre of music I need to need to carve out for the show. Man, the one thing I was trying to research and I cannot find is I don't understand how the music video, which I don't know if you've seen, but how that translated into the specific version of the dance that I've seen today, because there are elements of it that are similar, but a lot of it is just like just an excuse to touch the other participants on the bum, as far as I can tell.
I don't know how the dance comes about. I don't know, but it was huge, that dance. Like Bill Clinton did it and stuff. It won him the election.
Yeah. And there's a famous thing with Al Gore as well, where he made a joke about doing it, and he said he was going to demonstrate the Al Gore version of the Macarena, and he just stood still and then went, would you like to see it again? Which, not bad. Not a bad joke.
Yeah, he's the funniest guy ever. He's one of my idols. One of my comedic heroes is Al Gore.
Yeah, Mike Myers and Al Gore, top two.
I loved them.
It is the thing I find weirdest about this song is that, like, it feels weird to me that this song was written and came into existence, because it feels like a song that's been around forever. It's like I heard recently that the high five was invented in the late 70s, and I was like,
invented?
Yeah, like
that's,
like
how is that? That's crazy.
Yeah,
someone like, just go like, let me patent this. Two guys touching hands for 1 second.
It was two guys on the LA Dodgers.
Wow.
And then that was coined as a term, and then like, so that's what I mean. Like, you'd think a high five has been around for forever, but someone started that somewhere in the '70s, and then just people do it. And the same with the Macarena. Like, there was a time where the Macarena didn't exist, and then all of a sudden, it's like. Like, there's no man, woman, or child on this earth who wouldn't, like, instinctively stick their hands out and start doing the dance if they heard the Macarena. Or, like, would join in and go, ha! Like, at the end.
Yeah.
Like, it's... Yeah.
Exactly. And I think it, you know, maybe it did get passed down in those Ten Commandments from Moses. Maybe that was one of the... It was on the other side of that stone tablet. Like, God's like, I got another message for you guys. You're not ready yet, but keep it around. Humanity must know.
Very Marty McFly, that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you guys aren't ready for this, but like 2,000 years from now, they're going to love it.
But your great, 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 great grandkids are going to go freaking filthy for this.
my Christian upbringing kicked in there. As I said, 2,000 years from Moses to now, that's very wrong.
Somewhat wrong. Back then, time doesn't matter so much. It's just like, it was before Jesus sometime.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, yeah. About 6,000 years, I reckon, because my My dad at one point was a young Earth creationist and sort of talked to me a lot about it. So, oh my god. Yeah. Anyway, song 15 is a song you think everyone should listen to. So you went for Silly Games by Janet Kay.
Yeah, I just love this song. This is and more in that kind of reggae zone again. It is Lover's Rock, which is like soft, loveful reggae music. Yeah. And I think that I chose this as a song that I think everyone should listen to because there are a lot of, how can I put this, sex songs that are played out. You can't listen to like Let's Get It On by Marvin Gaye or anything to get jiggy. You can't. Okay. It's been played too much. You'll start laughing.
Yeah.
This is a lustful, sexy song about no more silly games. Let's start fucking. And I think that is, people need that in their lives, you know?
Sure.
People need a new song that's not hack yet. It's not being played out. And I think Silly Games is the great candidate for it. It's just a beautiful song. It's like kind of romantic, kind of sexy. I first heard it in Small Axe episode 2 or film number 2, Lover's Rock by the great Steve McQueen. And yeah, it was beautiful. And I just like that moment stuck with me. There's a lot of heat in this song. A lot of heat.
Yeah, sure. Okay, excellent. That's a first. Not having.
I pray you take your wife to this song one day. I pray that is what is in your future. I pray that I bestow that upon you as well now, Shane. That you will. This song will be in your rotation.
What's very funny is it's not public knowledge that my wife is pregnant at this point. So if I ignore that and then just like put this episode out and then shortly after announce that she's that I'm leaving the show because she's pregnant,
that's awesome.
People
that's
can put awesome. Two and two together. Yeah.
Wow. And I become like, godfather of the child.
I was gonna say in September, no, like, welcome to the world, baby Alexi.
Yeah, well, of course, you know, silly games, it speeds up that gestation period if you consummate to silly games, you know, it's a 3-month pregnancy, very exciting.
Oh, God. Also very funny, because it's sort of been, it's been something I've thought about before, it's something I've talked about on Instagram before, because Mish, who I've mentioned, and Zach Rubin, were on Confessions with Sammy P, and they ended up talking about this show because I can't remember how. I think because I think I'd said to them individually that I got into a lot of my Australian comedy through Confessions, and I actually knew Zach through Confessions before I knew him from Antidonna. But they were just riffing about this song, and it just became nonsense. But they ended up talking about like one of the categories in the show is like what song you fuck to. And Mish said, like, if Shane asked me that, I would immediately hang up, because that's so vulnerable and so. So yeah, it's good to have the other side of the coin there and have like you know, just be very.
I'll
open
put
to
it
this
upon
is,
you.
Yeah,
I encourage everyone to fuck to this song. That's it. If I can do that, I want to start a new generation. I want to start a new generation of people.
Yeah, sure.
Just a whole, you know, not a new generation of anything, a new generation of people. I want to start that with this song, you know?
Yeah, good. Okay, cool.
Had you heard this song before?
No. I did really like it, yeah. It's a great song. I was also reading that the Dennis Bovell? Who wrote the song? He said that he like when in approaching the composition, he said there's an advert for Memorex where Ella Fitzgerald sings a note and breaks a glass, and he basically was like, "I'm gonna put a song I got in this song." So the silly games where like she hits the really high falsetto, he was like, "That is gonna be a song that every female who's dancing to the song will try and hit that note." Which I think is great. I think I love that in music where like Dave Grohl's talked about a couple of things as well. He's done in the past like with Foo Fighters songs where like there's a song called I think it might be Nowhere, where no, it's not called Nowhere. It doesn't matter. There's a song that he's no, yeah, the Christmas song that Foo Fighters did called Nowhere. There's a song that the Foo Fighters wrote which is. They basically, it was because in European audiences, crowds bounce instead of like dancing, and they hadn't seen that before, so they're like, okay, we're gonna write a song that the crowd can really bounce to and end up being like a great Foo Fighters song. I just love little moments like that where people are like, I'm just gonna put this little thing in there and it's gonna really resonate with people, and this is like this is exactly that, just that one little note that people are gonna be like, it's great.
Yeah, it's good shit, man. Good shit. Yeah. I would recommend the Lovers Rock from the Small Axe Pentology or whatever from Steve McQueen. It is beautiful, like 70-minute film about set at like a house party in the 70s. It's just beautiful.
Perfect. Excellent. Alrighty. Also, good to know there's any to end on there, Lexi. So, do you have anything that you want to plug up and promote while I have you?
Absolutely. I have got a new podcast or a new show, because it's on YouTube as well, called The Last Video Store, which is, you know, I'm the last of my kind. I'm a video store clerk. I'm in a mythical video store that has every single film on its shelves. Guests will come in. They are my customers. I'll sign them up to the store, and then they're able to get out a rental combo of some of their favorite movies, one new release and two weeklies. And then I'll give them a staff pick, bespoke, customized recommendation based on their taste. So we had Cameron James, my buddy, has been on. Hacksaw Ridge and Elvis star Luke Bracey. Polly Bennett, who's the choreographer of Saltburn. We had Angela White, who's like the biggest porn star in the world, come on just the other day. And then this is coming out in a couple of weeks, right? So I can say people. Nina Oyama is on. Zach Ruane, Tony Armstrong, Anna Bronowski, who is like my documentarian hero, my mentor. Goran Stolevski, who's a filmmaker in Australia, who's got a new film coming out. Probably Miranda Tapsell, another great Aussie movie star. Lots of cool people. Lots of cool people. I'm trying to reel in some big fish. We got someone really big on the hook right now that I can't say because it could jinx and it might not happen. But we got some big fish out there that we're trying to reel in.
Perfect. Amazing.
Yeah. YouTube as well. It's on YouTube. You can watch on YouTube. Listen to us as a podcast, watch on YouTube. We got a green screen, so it looks like we're in a blockbuster from the 80s. It's awesome.
Good. Link in the description and all that. But yeah, thank you so much, Alexi. Appreciate it.
Thank you, brother Shane. Thank you very much. And congratulations on roughly 86 episodes of the podcast.
And that is it for episode 87 of Mixtaping Identity. Thank you so much for listening. Go and support Alexi however you can. If you haven't already watched the last video store, go and watch that. It is the perfect concept for a movie-based chat, and Alexi is so good at it. Like, he's just so knowledgeable and insightful and funny. It's a perfect blend. You have to watch it. I'm sure you're already aware of it if you're listening to this show, but Finding Drago is one of my favorite podcasts of all time. So if you haven't listened to that, go and listen to that. It's incredible. And if you have listened to that and you haven't listened to this show before, Cameron James has been on the show, and David from the House of Noi was actually my first ever guest on this show, so you can go check those out if you haven't done so already. If you like this show and you want to support it, a couple of different ways you can do that. We do have a Ko-fi link set up, so if you want to support us financially and keep the show going, you can do that. There's no monthly obligation there unless you want one, but any support there would be much appreciated. Beyond that, if you're not in a position to do that, totally understandable. Please do support the show in other ways. Leave a review, tell your friends, rate the show 5 stars wherever you can. All that good stuff. It really does help with keeping the show going and making me feel a little bit better about myself. So everybody wins. I will be back next week for episode 88. So in the meantime, look after yourselves. I'll speak to you then.